Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is mastering engineer Colin Leonard, who's going to talk about his online analog mastering process called Aria. First of all, I want to talk about the music business in Japan, because it's so interesting and so different from what we have here in the United States. There's a lot of people that have been in the business for a really long time that are complaining about the way things are today in terms of streaming, in terms of online royalties, digital royalties, and how they don't get paid the same way and the same amounts. But the interesting thing is, even though most of the world has moved on, Japan has not. It's the second largest music market in the world, believe it or not. For a small country like that, it's not that far behind the United States in terms of total revenue. And the reason for that is the fact that it's still a CD-based music economy. Yeah, 78% of the revenue in Japan comes from CDs versus about 39% in the US, which 39% is still a lot higher than you'd think, because everybody thinks that everything comes from digital anymore, and it really doesn't. Only about 8% of the total revenue in Japan comes from digital, as opposed to 68% in the United States. There's a number of other factors that actually play into this. The first thing is, in Japan, they're very big on CD rentals. And of course, that never caught on here in the United States, but there it's a really big deal. Even though it's falling a little bit, it's still a lot of money that they take in for people renting. And the fact is, no one worries about pirating because it's just not part of their culture. But also, they feel that it gets people in the mood to buy. They rent, they feel that CD in their hands, and they want to buy one later. The other thing that's really big are CD singles, and that never caught on in the United States. One fact that blew my mind is the fact that there are 6,000 music stores in Japan. Now, just to put that in perspective, in the United States, in the huge country that it is, there are only 1,900 left. So that just goes to show that music is such a huge business as compared to the way it is in the United States. It's big, but it's not huge as compared to Japan. Another thing that's interesting is the fact that CDs in Japan are the equivalent of about $23 to $28 each, which is far more than what we paid here. Even at their peak, they were only about $19.95, and most of them were priced far less than that. So you can see why Japan has a lot of music revenue. The other thing is, they're not discounted there. There's actually a law that sets the minimum price for most products. So you won't find something like a big box store doing a loss leader like, again, we have in the States. There's yet another factor in Japan. They love physical things. It's part of the culture. They would rather touch something, and a CD is more than a way to deliver music. It's merchandise, and they really like that. In fact, in Japan, they like cash more than credit. And the reason why, again, it's something tangible that's in their hands. So you can see that all of these factors put together make that a supremely unique market, especially for the music business. And for those who really want the music business the way it was 20 years ago, boy, Japan is the way to go, because it's certainly much different than the way it is here. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget to check out my 101 Mixing Tricks program and my other online video courses at bobbyosinskicourses.com. You can also check out my music industry and music production blogs. Just go to bobbyosinski.com to find the links, and you can also find excerpts for my books there. So, does music help you concentrate? When you really have to concentrate on something outside of your music business, and everybody's listening to this as a musician or an engineer or producer, and outside of that business, if you have to concentrate on something, if you have to write something, for instance, or do something that's labor-intensive, does music in the background help you concentrate? Now, I know for me it doesn't, because what ends up happening, it distracts me and I begin to listen too much. I begin to listen more like a producer, and I'm thinking, wow, that was cool the way they doubled that. I love the effect there. All those things that really make listening to music just as kind of something in the background doesn't work for me. That being said, so many people use it to help them focus. And in fact, it's been found that music does help you concentrate. Well, One of the things that scientists have found is the fact that the brain likes music. They don't really know why, but the brain really likes music. So that's the first thing. But the other thing that science has found is the fact that there are actually two attention systems in your brain. One that's conscious and provides focus on the detail that you're doing, and there's one that's unconscious, and it's basically more sensual, anything that feeds the senses. The unconscious attention is actually simpler, it's faster, and it's linked to our emotions. But what science has found is that it doesn't shut down ever. No matter how much you're focusing on something, the unconscious attention is always there. Now, it turns out that if you're doing something boring, repetitive, for instance, that unconscious attention can actually be very disruptive. It makes it very easy for you to get distracted. And I'm sure we've all been there where we're doing something that's relatively repetitive and all of a sudden we're off on something else because we're distracted by a sound, by a noise, whatever. That's our unconscious attention. The other thing when it comes to music is the type of music is really important. Music that you really like can help you focus, and on the other hand, if you don't like it, it will really impede your focus. So I know what your question is. What's the best music to help me focus? Believe it or not, it's video game soundtracks. Out of all the music that's available, the genre that's least distracting is video game soundtracks, and the reason why it's designed to actually help you focus your attention. Because let's face it, when you're playing a video game, you really have to be focused, and the music is helping you do that. So, if you have to do a task where you have to focus for a long period of time, that's the music that you should be listening to. My guest today is mastering engineer Colin Leonard, who's created an automated analog online mastering process called ARIA. The process uses Colin's analog mastering signal path and provides a way of getting high-quality mastering very quickly at an inexpensive price. I spoke with Colin via Skype from his studio in Atlanta. Let's start first by telling me how this all came about.
I guess some of it was just being loaded up with a lot of work and sometimes being pretty overwhelmed about how fast people need stuff turned around. I think a lot of busy mastering engineers kind of, I'm sure, feel that same frustration sometimes when it's just, you know, the deadlines are kind of not really realistic and not really real, but your clients still kind of set those deadlines for you. So a lot of times if you don't get those projects done on time, you just don't get those projects. So part of it was that. Part of it was I kind of have a from mastering so many songs, I kind of have like a setup that I start with, and I kind of learned that with some automation in the analog realm, it was just kind of a brainstorm, you know. I kind of think outside the box a lot with mastering, so I just had this crazy brainstorm about doing this, and I was like, man, this would be really awesome. And this was before I had heard of any other systems that were doing automated mastering at all. You know, maybe there were others already in the works. I don't know if there were any launched, actually. Mm-hmm. But it's pretty a unique idea that we're doing it in the analog domain.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, I can't even imagine. It doesn't seem to go together somehow. You know, when you're talking about automated mastering, you just naturally go to digital.
Right. Yeah. I think you can do pretty good work in the digital domain. You know, some guys really do. I don't as much. You know, I just like analog. So, you know, part of it is just using the tools, like the tools that are used in the ARIA system are basically all the tools that I use in my mastering setup. So it's a full analog mastering studio setup that the ARIA system uses.
Okay, but that said, it is automated. I mean, it has to be for it to work, and it also is at least partially in the digital domain because it comes into you that way.
Right. Yeah, it comes in digital. We do a bunch of scans and, quick snapshots of the audio in the digital domain when it comes in. And then it actually uses our custom software, plays back on one computer, goes through a really high-end mastering D2A converter through the whole analog chain. The analog chain has automation elements built in, and then it gets recorded again in the digital domain after a really high-end A to D converter, and then exported. We can really control the export into any formats that we want, and we're actually hosting. The whole system is hosted in-house, so the servers are here, which makes it really fast, because as soon, you know, the file actually goes directly from you directly to our server. So it's immediate, you know, it doesn't have to go to like a third party server company, which would mean your WAV file would have to go to like, you know, another server somewhere in Arizona or, and then come to us. It actually comes straight to us. So as soon as it's mastered, it hits your account in the ARIA system.
Yeah. But that being said, it sounds like you can only work on one song at the same time.
Yeah, right now, the system has a pretty surprising capacity. And as soon as we hit about 20%, we're going to add systems each time we hit 20%. So we just kind of figure that that's going to keep the wait times down.
How long did it take you to develop the idea to where you finally launched it online?
I had the idea in 2013, so and we've been working on it for about 2 years or more, pretty much straight through. It's been kind of, I've been, you know, I've financed the whole thing from mastering, so I've been busy mastering and then juggling this at the same time. So I think it probably could have been a little faster if I didn't have to do that. But I just didn't want to do the whole, I wanted to control everything and be able to adjust it and not have to worry about doing silly marketing or anything. So so I just wanted to do the whole thing myself.
Okay. Philosophically, though, aren't mastering engineers opposed to automated mastering?
Yeah. I think as I've seen online, most of them are. But I think it's a different product than what I offer at Sing Mastering. I mean, for one thing, budgets have dropped majorly. And, you know, people aren't making as much money with music anymore. There are some clients that want to pay good money to have a professional mastering engineer really take the time and the detail and work on their stuff in a collaborative way. But there's also clients that, one, maybe don't have the money to spend that on their project. You know, maybe it's not that important of a project to them, or maybe they need it in like an hour. So I think it kind of fills a void for a couple of different scenarios with clients.
I get that. Isn't there some pushback from, well, I know there is because I've seen the forums, and pushback from mixers as well, from clients? And most of it is the fact that they don't believe it could happen to the degree that you can personally do it, you know, the traditional way. And I'm not saying their mind won't be changed, but, you know, that there's that initial feeling that perhaps they're equating this with some of the other lower priced versions that are available online that don't do a particularly great job.
Right.
So, I mean, that's just a byproduct being lumped in together, you know, with those as well. So how do you differentiate yourself?
Well, I haven't had much. Most of my beta testers were really good mixing engineers, and they are still using it every single day. It, you know, I'm not paying them or anything. If they didn't like it, they wouldn't waste their time and use it. I haven't had a lot of pushback from mixing engineers online. It's almost all been mastering engineers online. Mm. Mixing engineers, I think, might be a little skeptical because of the way stuff is marketed in the music industry in general. And I've really tried not to, you know, everything that we say on our website is honest, and we're not you know, doing any type of like shiny marketing promotion or anything. I'm just trying to let people use it and try it. And if they like it, then great. I think it's a really good tool. I don't know how we differentiate. I think the quality is going to need to speak for itself. And I think it's going to be kind of the same way a real mastering engineer that's good kind of makes it is mostly word of mouth. And I think that's what's going to happen with this. I'm just kind of giving it to mixing engineers that I know and letting them use it, and they're loving it. So I think, you know, part of the idea was that it creates reference level material. A lot of professional mixers create mixes that are as loud as most commercially released music to get approval from the clients. I think it's a very competitive industry to be a mixing engineer as far as loudness goes right now. Usually the clients think that the louder one is better. It's really competitive where the tracking engineer does a rough mix and it might be like super slammed through a limiter and loud, and then the really good mixing engineer makes one that's lower and the client's upset. So I think it kind of fills a void for mixing engineers, so they don't have to focus on the loudness thing. It's almost like they're giving a mastered reference.
Okay, well, speaking of which then, so how loud is it when it comes out the other side?
It depends on the mix. There's four settings. There's a little YouTube video that's up that it kind of explains with samples. It explains how to set the four mix type settings that are on the program. But there are four settings. They kind of go in order of compression, A, B, and C. And then D is kind of a special setting that's a little bit different. So it depends kind of what you're going for. And within a couple of days, once you pick a certain setting, you're not married to that setting. If you go in to look at your file in the My Account page, you can remaster it at a lower level or a louder level if you want at no extra charge. So you can kind of play with the levels of each song. Both A and D actually are very safe settings, and they're not like, you know, pushed extremely. B and C have a lot more analog push to them, which can be great with certain types of mixes. So yeah, you really have to kind of just, once you kind of play around with it a few times, I think it's pretty easy to get the hang of. But if you're trying it for the first time, watching the video really helps pick the right settings.
Yeah, I wish I would have known about that, because I would have watched it before we talked, but because it sounds like it does explain a lot of yeah, the differences. And also, I didn't realize that it was possible to have a redo.
Yeah. Yeah. That way you don't have to re-upload your song again. And you don't have to be married to the setting you pick. So, you know, the default setting is B. It's probably a good place to start for most songs. Like it kind of covers rock and R&B and rap. But if you have like something that's acoustic and you want it very open, then A is probably what you want to do. If you have a really loud pop song that needs to be super competitive, then C is the one to use for that. And then D is kind of designed to, it's a clean setting, but it's more for like a pop ballad that needs to be loud, but it's not necessarily like the type of song that you would normally make loud. So that's kind of what that's designed for.
Yeah, one of the things I've always noticed is, I just went to a hi-fi show, first one in a long, long time that I've gone to anyway. And as I listened to the demo material, what everyone kept on saying, oh, that sounds great, that sounds great, it was the stuff with the most dynamic range. And I noticed it at AES too, it's the same thing. When people demonstrate their speakers or their gear, it's always stuff with a lot of dynamic range.
Yeah.
And we equate that as being, you know, high fidelity, so to speak. And yet, when it comes down to it, we don't want that sound on our mixes. It's the most bizarre, you know, dichotomy of thinking about this.
Right. So, I think part of it comes down to the systems that people are using for playback now too. I think that at a hi-fi show with really big, amazing hi-fi speakers, those handled those dynamics a lot better than, you know, the system that you get at Best Buy or your cell phone or your earbuds.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard for a lot of these little small drivers to handle that type of dynamic range. But yeah, we live in a kind of competitive loudness world, and that's, you know, hopefully that changes a little bit, but that's kind of the way it is right now.
Okay, back to Aria for a second. Mm-hmm. You have three levels of buying the product. One is a per song,
mm-hmm.
and the other two are subscription. And I can understand the B level of subscription was 10 songs a month. The pro level, 100 songs per month. Who do you think is going to buy that?
So those subscriptions, the way those work is those aren't actually, they don't have to be yearly. So you can actually buy a subscription for a month and get 100 songs in a month if you have maybe a big album with a bunch of versions. That way you'll be able to do it a lot cheaper than what the single rate is. A lot of the busy mixing engineers are really putting through a lot of material because they'll have the main passes, and then they might, what the really cool thing is, some of the really good mixers that are using it a lot, like Phil Tan is using it a lot, and Fabian Maraschulo is using it a lot, and those are both like amazing, like Grammy winning mixers. But they'll like run it through and use it as a tool to adjust things in the mix. So they'll run it through once, and then I see it come through again in 2 minutes. And then I'll see it come through the same song again in 2 minutes later. And then it's off to their client as a reference. So what they'll do is they'll kind of see how it's reacting and then adjust little small things in their mix and then send it off to their client. And then once they have the approval, they'll send all the passes. So like main, instrumental, acapella, whatever. So that starts to add up kind of fast to 100 songs a month when they're doing, you know, one or two songs like that every single day.
Yeah, I can see how. Okay, so if they're doing that then they're using the process as the final master they're turning in.
I think that they're leaving it up to the client and whether or not to, you know, a lot of times those, they don't really have the decision making as far as where the song goes for mastering, which I think is a little scary to them too, because sometimes they end up with a bad result that they didn't have any control over. So this, for one thing, gives a mastering guy an example of what was approved by the client. And if they, but it might go to mastering, you know, it's not, they're not saying it's, you know, they were giving loud references before they started using Aria. Aria just does a better version of that for them.
Hmm.
You know, a better version of the loud master.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. Very cool. Okay. So who do you perceive as your customer then for the one-offs?
I think those could be more independent, mixers or independent artists that have a single to put out. You know, I do a lot of singles as far as my regular mastering, and not everyone has the budget to pay me for a single. So I think it's kind of a single driven world right now. So there's a lot of independent artists that just kind of do one song at a time.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the way of the future, actually.
Yeah.
You know, more so than doing an album where you spend all that time and you don't know what's going to happen with it, where if you do one at a time, it's easier to tailor it to your fan base. And, you know, there's all sorts of different reasons why that works better, you know, in our music 4.0 life
right.
that we're in today. Where do you think mastering is headed, given the fact that now we're in this realm of automation, so to speak, which you're in the forefront? So how's this going to change for everybody if it catches on?
I think when I was kind of doing some research about this idea in the beginning, we tried to find out how many new songs are released every day. And it's just a ton, especially when you look at SoundCloud and iTunes, and this, you know, how many songs are added to the streaming services each day and each month. It's just a ridiculous amount of songs. There's a lot of music coming out and a lot of different levels of artists. And I think it just gives them another option. So I'm not really sure. I mean, I think that there's always room for personal mastering, which is what I do at Sing Mastering. But I think it's really nice to give another good sounding option that's more convenient and less money. You know, I think it's nice for the client to be able to, maybe they don't want to talk to me. Maybe they just want to sit at home and run a song in 5 minutes at 3 a.m. and have it back. And I think, you know, I think that's kind of a reality. You know, we kind of live in like a Amazon Prime world.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think there's a big convenience factor. So, I mean, I do think there's room for really good high level custom mastering. But I think there's also a market for a more convenient, less expensive automated mastering service.
Given the fact that YouTube and Apple Radio and Apple Music to some degree now is basically doing auto leveling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Normalization.
Normalization. And for the most part, the stuff that has more dynamic range sounds better as a result.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How is that affecting both what you're doing as a mastering engineer and Aria?
Well, Aria can actually, and I can too, we can spec stuff to the normalization ranges to kind of make it ideal for those. Mm. I don't think that's necessarily hit us in the United States as much as it has overseas yet, but I think it's going to. It's just a matter of time before I think that happens. But I've actually had a lot of experience in with some of my friends in television, and they are releasing everything at COMACT specifications, which is a loudness standard that is kind of best for all devices, and it keeps everything pretty locked down as far as there being no battle over loudness.
Right.
And the cool thing is, One of the guys is actually using Aria for his TV spots, like big national TV spots. So Aria really can still sound dynamic and good even when it's like at COMAC spec.
So does that mean you can specify the LUFS level that you want?
Yeah, we can set it up to export any loudness normalization scheme that we want. We can set it up to export master for iTunes, which is coming in eventually, like within the next couple weeks. You'll be able to have a 16-bit wave file, a high-quality MP3, a 24-bit wave file, and mastered for iTunes all in your download folder.
Wow. That is cool. That's worth the dough.
Yeah, totally. And I think it's cool because, you know, I'm mastering every day. So as this stuff kind of changes, I just keep tweaking the system for what is going on in the marketplace.
Yeah.
In the professional world. So we'll just keep up with Aria and keep it updated to what kind of is the standard at the time. So, but yeah, I mean, I think it's nice having the normalization. You know, I wish that was a little more in effect because it's a little more focus on like, let's just make this sound awesome. And less of like, let's just make this as loud as possible.
Yeah. Well, of course, we've been playing the loudness wars for what, 30 years, really?
Yeah.
Probably
at
more.
Yeah, 60s, 50s,
yeah,
60s.
Definitely. I'm sure you've done this, but I have to ask the question anyway. How closely have you looked at the competition? In terms of you know, have you done a lot of comparisons just to see where you're at, or?
I have done like two comparisons. And I mean, to me, it's not really a close competition. And I think partly because I think I'm the only mastering engineer doing this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's doing work on major label stuff. I don't think, you know, nobody else is really doing this. So really what I wanted to do is take the tools from really good professional mastering and put them into a really good automated system. So, you know, the way the system works is more of a frequency analysis, not as much a genre analysis, because I don't really think music works that way. So I get a lot of different genres as far as mastering goes, and I don't think you can really lump them into like EQ it by genre type of thing. you know, you could have a jazz record that has drums that sounds like hip hop, but it's not hip hop. So you can't say this is hip hop. So, you know, music, I think, and I think that's what's cool about the Ariasism is that it sounds really musical and natural. So, but yeah, I listened to like two things and that was it in comparison.
I'm sure your clients have done more comparisons though.
Yeah, I've seen some reports, you know, that they really like the Aria masters. So that's great to hear.
Yeah, yeah. The only problem you have there is the fact that, well, there's one competitor in particular that's already locked in SoundCloud and a few other platforms, which, you know, makes it hard to break in. But in a way, that actually might be better for you because it's better differentiation, I think, in terms of quality.
Yeah, I think it's a different product. I think we're kind of a higher quality product. I mean, even though it's automated, I mean, you know, your stuff's running like through like $200,000 worth of analog stuff, you know? I mean, it's not like just cookie cutter type of algorithm, you know? It's really high quality analog stuff. So, you know, I think it makes a really big difference as far as the depth and the clarity of the masters.
Can you say what the gear is? Is it proprietary or are there some off the shelf things?
Some of it is. I mean, some of it is, and then some of it's like very unique older stuff that I use in my mastering stuff, but it's generally the same stuff that I'm using in my mastering every day. So yeah, I mean, I'm not gonna go into exact details about everything that's in it gear wise, but it's all very high-end stuff.
Well, I know last time we talked, you said that you had a process that you do that's proprietary that seemed to be the secret sauce that everybody really liked.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on the song too. So, you know, I try not to get stuck at all in doing the same thing every time. And Aria is kind of like that too. So, what's been interesting is I've really like tweaked Aria for a long time. Even before I started beta testing, I had this up in the studio and I would master a song and then I would do the Aria thing and run some passes through Aria and then compare the two and then I would tweak Aria. So it's really cool that I'm kind of like teaching it as it goes. And now I'm kind of tuning it. It's different because you're not tuning someone's exact song by ear, but it's more of a global type of thing. So, you know, every day I'll pull down some songs and take a listen and see what's going on with the system. But it's pretty amazingly close sometimes, depending on the mixes to what, you know, I had a mix the other day that was a really good mix and the mixer had run it through Aria and gotten probably all that he could have gotten out of the Aria system. And then I spent I got the job to master the song and then I spent like an hour mastering it. And then I pulled up the Aria version and it was like, the client's not even going to know. Like, yeah. I mean, it's not always like that, but someone with that has good ears that had some practice with the system can definitely get a really, really good product from it.
Yeah. But it's like pretty much the way it's always been. If you have a great mix, it's so much easier to do whatever it is you got to do.
Yeah. And well, I think that's part of the problem with some mastering too. I think sometimes there's a couple of things. Like one thing is that I think once you start going too far with a mix, it kind of loses its soul and it loses any of the like good vibe that it had. So, and Aria doesn't do that. You know, it doesn't really overwork it. And I think that's important. I also think that sometimes, and I've been guilty of this too, you hear a song a certain way and you kind of get an image of what you want to do in your head. And it's not necessarily, I don't think, the best thing for that mix. You know, sometimes you have to take yourself, get out of your head a little bit and view the mix as something creative that somebody did. And I think some, you know, a lot of mixers and artists don't really like it when, you know, an engineer might try to do too much to a song.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think you can really kind of make things worse by doing that.
Well, I know the old classic engineers, one in particular, Ken Scott. I would have these conversations with them all the time. And Ken, of course, came up through the Abbey Road system, and part of what they had to do was they became mastering engineers before they became mixing engineers. So
right.
He spent like 2 years mastering and knew the process well, knew it in terms of what had to happen going to vinyl.
Right.
And of course, this is the 60s, and the thinking was a little bit different, but his philosophy was, I'm giving it to the mastering engineer the way I want to hear it. I don't want them to do anything with it beyond that, which kind of defeats the purpose of you know, having a creative mastering engineer, I think. But that's the way a lot of those guys think.
Yeah, I mean, the mastering engineers at that time were, those were the entry-level positions.
Yeah.
You know, we've kind of turned it into this art form thing, which I think is kind of good and bad. I think sometimes you kind of have to, like, you know, come back down to earth and realize, like, it's a customer service business. And, you know, it's getting the job done and getting it done quickly and doing it well. But it's not as much, I mean, it's not that big of a deal. I mean, I really focus on doing as good a quality work as possible. But also, you know, it's not like you're not the artist on this project. You know, you're someone that's going to help the artist put out their vision for it. And it's not necessarily your thing.
Well,
I think that's important.
We're all in the service business. So when it's all said and done. Well, very cool. Good luck with this. Good luck with Aria.
Thank you.
Great idea. And again, it's coming from the right place. I know. I'm so happy that someone like you is doing this rather than tech in Silicon Valley putting it together. So that's very cool.
Right. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I think that's what makes it a little bit different, is that it really is somebody that's mastering every day, tuning the system and, you know, having control of everything in the system. I think that's really important, or it's just not going to move forward as a thing that people do. So I do think it's important.
To find out more about the Aria process, go to ariamastering.com. That's one word, ariamastering.com. You can also check out Colin at Sing Mastering, all one word, singmastering.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyosinski.com, or find it in iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyosinski.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.